From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a concert and interview with singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. She describes her songs as Southern Gothic. Her influences include Bob Dylan, Hank Williams, Robert Johnson, and writers Flannery O'Connor and Eudora Welty. Also, President Bush blames the gridlocked Congress for our economic problems. Is our government deadlocked? And if so, why? And who's responsible? We'll talk with Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. He's been covering politics for 28 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. Air Force transport planes landed in Somalia today carrying tons of relief supplies. The BBC's Colin Blaine traveled with one crew of relief workers.
Bella Twain isn't the neediest place in Somalia, but it gave the United States operation the chance of an uneventful beginning. The town has experienced aid workers on the ground, and security there is far better than in many parts of the country. Four Hercules transport planes delivered 34 tons of rice, beans, and oil for use in Red Cross feeding centers. There's been criticism of the timing of the American airlift since the announcement came during the presidential election campaign, a charge rejected by United States relief advisor Andrew Natsios.
The United States was among the first countries in here. We've distributed 80,000 tons of food. We didn't do that when the election campaign started. We started doing that last October.
Mr. Natsios also lent his support to the call for more UN troops to be sent as observers, unaware that two of the 50 already in Mogadishu had just been shot and wounded by gunmen.
The BBC's Colin Blaine. A group of bandits armed with tanks and other heavy weaponry attacked a relief depot in Mogadishu, the Somali capital, today, and stole hundreds of tons of supplies. The bandits got away with 25 trucks, tons of food, and the entire supply of emergency fuel for the UN's World Food Program. The UN has authorized 500 armed guards to protect the food shipments in Mogadishu and is considering sending 3,000 more for outlying areas. One of Somalia's most powerful faction leaders, General Mohamed Farah Aidid, told UN officials today that he opposes more troops. American warplanes continue to enforce the no-fly zone over southern Iraq, and U.S. officials report that so far there's been no resistance. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
Pentagon spokesman said by this morning U.S. forces had flown a total of 90 sorties in the area. Just in case the Iraqi military hadn't gotten the message, U.S. warplanes are dropping leaflets warning it not to fly aircraft in the region or use radar. The leaflets warn pilots, don't fly or you'll be shot down, and warn radar operators, don't point at us or you'll suffer the consequences. Aboard the U.S. carrier Independence, jets have been taking off at 45-minute intervals for the around-the-clock patrol codenamed Operation Southern Watch. The patrols include combat planes capable of striking air or ground targets, jets loaded with electronic jamming gear, and AWACS surveillance aircraft. According to pilots, they've been flying high to avoid attracting anti-aircraft fire. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 13 points to close at 3,267.6. Advances led declines by a slight margin in moderate trading. This is NPR. Critics of the Federal Emergency Management Agency say that the agency hasn't improved since it allegedly botched South Carolina's recovery from Hurricane Hugo in 1989. FEMA is being widely blamed for the government's slow response to Hurricane Andrew in South Florida and Louisiana. Representative Bill Green, a New York Republican, said FEMA failed to learn anything from the 1989 disaster. FEMA officials say they're being unfairly asked to respond faster than humanly possible. The agency says it's also coping with Los Angeles recovery from the riots last spring. Authorities in northern Idaho have gotten their first response from a fugitive white supremacist whose armed standoff with federal agents has resulted in two deaths, Lee Garnett reports.
Randy Weaver has answered questions shouted through a bullhorn by his sister, who has arrived on the scene from Iowa. According to an FBI spokesman, Weaver said he needs no help in the eighth day of the siege, which began began when Weaver's 14-year-old son and a federal marshal died in a burst of automatic weapon fire. FBI Special Agent Gene Glenn says the communication, though limited, is a definite step in the right direction. Amplified taped messages from Weaver's relatives and friends urging him to surrender continue to be aimed at the Weaver cabin. The standoff has caused a delay in the opening of public schools in the county so that over 200 law officers can continue to use the high school gym as a barracks. For National Public Radio, this is Lee Garnett reporting.
Fire officials in Idaho say they're closer to containing the biggest wildfire in the West. The fire, about 30 miles east of Boise, has covered 258,000 acres over the past 9 days. Fire bosses say that with 20 miles of fire lines yet to be cut, the blaze probably won't be fully contained until September the 6th. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Several of us on Fresh Air are big fans of a singer-songwriter named Lucinda Williams. We had her on for a short interview a few years ago after the release of her album called Lucinda Williams. Now she has a new record called Sweet Old World, and she's performing tonight at the 31st Annual Philadelphia Folk Festival. So we invited her to our studios to play a few songs. She brought her guitarist Gerf Morlix with her. Williams was born in Louisiana and grew up around the South. The family moved around because her father, the poet Miller Williams, taught at different universities. Williams got her start as a folk singer. Her first album in 1979 featured Delta blues and traditional country songs. Since then, she's mostly played her own songs. She's going to play a couple of songs from her new album, but we're going to open her concert with a song I particularly like from her previous album. Here's Lucinda Williams and Gerf Morlix.
This is a song off the Rough Trade album. It's called I Just Want to See You So Bad. And I wrote this, it's a true story. I was driving from Houston to San Antonio at about midnight to see someone. Of course, I don't do things like that anymore. I wrote this about 10 or 11 years ago. About 11 years ago, I guess.
Sounded great. That's a song by my guest Lucinda Williams, who's with us, along with Gerf Morlix on electric guitar. And so, Lucinda, should I ask you what happened to that relationship after?
it didn't even evolve really into a relationship.
Yeah. you've described your songs as being country songs with rock and roll lyrics. What do you mean by that?
Well, sort of in the sense that the melodies are sort of basic and more kind of basic and traditional for the most part, but the lyrics are fairly contemporary, I guess.
And the setting's kind of rock and roll, too. I think you can get a sense of that with Gerf playing here, too. Do you know what
right.
I mean? And on the record, there's a more kind of full rock and roll band. Gerf,
yeah.
let me ask you, do you do any of the arrangements for it?
Yeah, we kind of put them all together, get the band together. And a lot of these just evolved on the road. We just start playing the songs, work them up at soundcheck.
I think it sounds great, but why did you want to head in that direction of working with a rock and roll band when you could have chosen a more country-oriented sound or a more folk-oriented sound?
Well, I just like that. It's just, I don't know, it's more fun to me, and it's more, it's not as limiting,
mm-hmm.
I think. You know, there's so many variations and things we can do, and we still do kind of straighter country stuff, and we just sort of incorporate it, you know, in between all the other stuff, so we can kind of just do whatever we want.
Well, you have a new album, and I want you to play the title song from it. It's called Sweet
okay.
Old World. Is this a song about someone who you know or knew?
Well, it sort of started off, you know, some songs I probably worked on this for about a year off and on, and sometimes I don't really know which direction a song is going to go in. I just sort of have an idea, and something might happen to sort of spur it on and kind of push it in a certain direction, and that's kind of what happened with this song. A friend of mine's father had committed suicide just sort of out of the blue, but it's not really just about that specific incident. It's just sort of kind of as a statement about that, I guess. You know, sort of speaking to that person.
Let's hear it.
1, 2, 3, 4.
See what you lost when you left this world, this sweet old world. What you lost when you left this world, this sweet old world. The breath from your own lips, the touch of fingertips, a sweet and tender. Thank you. what you lost when you left this world, this sweet old world. See what you lost when you left this world, this sweet old world. What you lost when you left this world, this sweet old world.
It's a beautiful song.
Thank you.
Listen, what was the reaction of your friend whose father committed suicide when you played the song for your friend?
She cried. You know, she was very touched.
You said it took you a year to write the song?
I think I'd kind of started it probably about that long ago and kind of would go back to it at different times and work on it a little bit and then kind of go back to it. And
did you ever write poetry without music before writing songs?
No, I really didn't. I sort of tried and fooled around with that a little bit, but I really didn't get into that.
Did that have anything to do with the fact that your father's a pretty well-known poet, Miller Williams? Did you feel intimidated by his writing?
No, I didn't feel intimidated. I just didn't feel like I could really do it. it's just a really different thing, I think.
How do you think it's different?
Yeah. Well, it has to stand alone without music and have sort of a rhythm of its own. And, you know, he can't really write songs either. I don't try to write poetry and he doesn't try. He does sort of try to write songs sometimes. He'll give me something, you know, and
Have you set one to music?
He won't write the music, but he'll write something that he thinks might be a good song and he'll give it to me and say, see what you can do with this. You know.
So have you ever done it?
I've tried, but you know, it's just a different thing.
Right, you're really on your own wavelength with your music too.
Yeah,
right?
It's hard to just take lyrics from someone else and just put music to them.
If you're just joining us, in the studio with us performing is Lucinda Williams, who has a new album called Sweet Old World, and with her on electric guitar is Gerf Morlix, who's also featured on the record, and they've been playing together for years. We're going to take a short break and talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Performing in the studio with us today, Lucinda Williams and Gerf Morlix. How did you both start performing together?
Well, we actually knew each other back in Houston in the mid-70s, but we weren't working together then. And then we both ended up in L.A., and a mutual friend of ours kind of put us together because I was trying to put a band together. And I guess that was about 85. Late 84, early 85.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Something like that.
Seems like forever.
Yeah, and so we've been together ever since.
Gerf, what's different for you playing with a rock and roll band and playing with a singer as a member of the band?
Basically nothing except the volume is a little louder with the band, but my style just is based on the song.
Uh-huh.
And if I don't have a song to play, then I might as well not be playing. So it's just a little louder, but, you know, if it was flat-out rock and roll, I'd still be, you know, thinking of the song as I was playing it.
You play with a lot of space. I think you use space really well in your playing.
Well, thanks. A lot of that comes from lack of technique. I have no choice.
He's
modest. I can't play anything fast, so I leave holes. And people seem to like that.
But that's become his trademark, I think, now.
Well, it makes for kind of real, like, a sensitive... accompaniment. Do you know what I mean?
You don't see that often, I don't think.
I didn't think so either, but I thought maybe I was wrong.
No, I don't think enough people do that, but it is partly because of a limitation. But I also, you know, just, you know, I'm backing up the singer, and the song has to come across. So I don't want to get in the way at all. So.
Yeah. Those limitations, I think, sort of become almost what people like.
Well, I think limitations always, often, anyways, get turned into strengths.
Because that's what I feel, how I feel about my singing, too. Yeah, I could say the same thing.
What would you see as your limitation?
My range. I'm not completely, I feel limited as a singer, you know. Gerf and I were talking about this when we were doing the album, you know, and he said, well, I feel limited as a guitar player, and you know, that really surprised me, but it, probably a lot of musicians, if you ask them, would say that.
And you put these songs across like no one else can, you know? It's like,
exactly, and there's an emotional feeling to your voice, too. And I don't know whether you might feel that it's hard for you to reach certain high notes, but as you're getting to them,
especially
there's just emotional
early
feeling to it that I think, you know, really comes across. I really like your singing a lot.
Thanks.
Are you self-conscious about performing?
Sometimes, yeah.
Wait, do you think of yourself more as the writer than the performer?
Yeah. Yeah. But I enjoy performing. I mean, yeah.
Well, now someone is, I think someone had already recorded one of your songs, but Mary Chapin Carpenter now has a recording of Passionate Kisses, which is a wonderful song of yours. I was trying to put myself in your shoes, which of course wasn't easy, but I was trying to imagine how I'd feel if someone else had released a single of my song. And now, in your circumstance, the album that it was on, it was a fantastic album that got rave reviews, but probably didn't sell all that much in the way that albums on independent labels don't sell all that much. And she's tending to sell a lot of records.
She's been doing
now.
Real well.
Yeah, so on the one hand, I'm sure you feel really great that the song's going to be getting out more, but on the other hand, you're going to feel a little bit of resentment if it does better than your version.
No. Not at all.
Uh-huh.
Quite the contrary. Well, I'm really flattered that she's doing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just more help for me, you know.
As a songwriter.
In my career and as a song, as exposure as a songwriter and everything. Because, you know, I think our audiences overlap a little bit. So, you know, that's just even better for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you to do another song from your new album.
Okay.
How about Six Blocks Away? That's going to be the single, right?
Yeah.
Right. So I guess we should do that.
did you ever have a single before?
Well, they tried to put a single out when I was on Rough Trade, but nothing really ever happened with it.
Okay. Well, we have Lucinda Williams, singer, songwriter, guitarist, Gerf Morlix on electric guitar, and this is from Lucinda's new album, Sweet Old World, and Lucinda and Gerf are in the studio with us playing in our studio. Here we go.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Sleeps all alone on Second Street with a roof over his head and food to eat. But he can hardly make it day to day, 'cause everything he wants is six blocks away, six blocks away. He's got a regular job and it pays the rent in a donut shop on 3rd and 10th. But he doesn't understand why she turned him away. He can hear her heartbeat six blocks away, six blocks away.
Six blocks away,
Dirty Old Street.
Six blocks away,
he can hear her heartbeat
six blocks away,
Dirty Old Street.
Six blocks away,
he can hear her heartbeat six blocks away. Walks real fast down the dirty street. He blocks away, dirty old street, six blocks away. He can hear heartbeats six blocks away, dirty old street, six blocks away. He can hear heartbeats six blocks away. Six blocks away. Six blocks away.
That's great, and that's what.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Terry.
Well, what I was going to say is that that's Lucinda Williams and Gurf Morlix, and it's a wonderful song. I hope
thanks.
Hope it does well, and I want to thank you both a lot for doing this concert for us.
Thanks, Terry.
And you're on the road now.
We're doing the Philadelphia Folk Festival, and we'll be doing some more touring in the fall.
Okay. Yeah. Like being on the road?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. That's nice.
We like to play.
Good. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for doing the concert. Listen to William's new album is called Sweet Old World. It's on Chameleon Records, which is part of Elektra. And I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. And I wonder if you could just play us out with something.
Sure. I can go down that big road by myself. I can go down that big road by myself. If I can carry you, I carry someone else. I ask him how about it, and he said, all right.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. President Bush says the gridlocked Congress is responsible for our economic problems. House Speaker Tom Foley says it's the president who's created the gridlock by vetoing the bills. What's going on here, and what is this deadlock about? We talked to Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. He's covered American politics for 28 years. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Federal disaster relief began arriving in hurricane-ravaged Dade County, Florida today, as the private relief effort is under tremendous strain. One local operation provided medical care to those who could reach a makeshift aid station. Rick Stone of member station WUSF reports.
Under a large blue tent pitched by the hospital corporation Humana in the wreckage of Florida City, doctors and nurses dispensed diabetes and insulin medication and treated the conditions that come with disaster and cleanup. Dr. Robert Switarski had been working all day.
We're seeing a lot of people with puncture wounds, people who need to have stitches that they had done the first couple of days of the hurricane check. A lot of people run out of diabetic medication mostly.
Late today, Humana teams were preparing an expedition to reach isolated migrant labor camps south of here. Conditions there are unknown, and armed guards were planning to accompany the doctors. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Florida City.
Tornadoes spawned by the remnants of Hurricane Andrew have skipped across Tennessee, causing injuries and damage. Sean Jacobson of member station WMOT reports from Murfreesboro.
Wayne Panter is with the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency. He says most of the damage was confined to the middle part of the state.
Damage reported in Williamson, Wilson, Marshall, Murray, and Sumner counties in middle Tennessee from tornadoes that apparently touched down. There were four injuries, including one pregnant woman in Marshall County.
Panter says a flash flood watch for much of the state has now expired, and most of the storms have moved out of the area.
The front apparently moves a lot quicker than what we thought, and it is just about moved off into Virginia and North Carolina at this time.
There's no damage estimate available yet. For National Public Radio, I'm Sean Jacobs in Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton charges the Republicans are misleading American voters about his Arkansas record. The Democrat called it a desperate attempt by the Bush campaign to cover up the president's poor economic record. Republicans have said Clinton increased taxes 128 times as governor of Arkansas, but that number counts some of the same taxes twice and includes many small fee increases. Today's Boston Globe quotes a Bush aide saying the campaign knows the number is false, but will continue using it because, in his words, it works. The Pentagon says U.S. warplanes are leafleting southern Iraq, warning Iraqi pilots that if they fly over the region, they risk being shot down. The United States is patrolling the area to protect Shiite Muslims from Iraqi airstrikes. France and Britain have said they'll join the operation. Their planes are reportedly on the way. The no-fly order went into effect yesterday. Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials gaining nearly 13 points to finish at 3267.61. This is NPR. The White House has offered $3 million to help pay for a new round of peace negotiations among warring factions of the former Yugoslavia. Spokesperson Marlon Fitzwater said today the talks will begin next week in Geneva. Fitzwater said President Bush was pleased with this week's London conference on the fighting in Yugoslavia. United Technologies Corporation today pleaded guilty to fraud and conspiracy charges in the Operation Ill Wind Pentagon procurement scandal. The Hartford, Connecticut-based company agreed to pay $6 million in penalties. United Technologies admitted it received inside information on defense contract bids. The situation of Brazilian President Fernando Collor, who faces impeachment proceedings, worsened today with the news that his wife is being indicted on charges of embezzlement. NPR's David Wellner has more from Rio de Janeiro.
First Lady Rosane Collor is being indicted by a federal police chief and a federal prosecutor for having allegedly funneled $500,000 to her family through the state-run charity she headed until last year. Investigators believe more than $50 million in all were stolen from the charity while President Collor's wife was in charge. It's been more than a year since the charity scandal surfaced, but this is the first of eight possible indictments against Mrs. Collor. It follows the release earlier this week of a politically explosive corruption report that implicates President Kohler in an influence peddling ring. The president is under intense pressure to resign before impeachment charges are brought to Congress next week. But Kohler has dug in his heels and refuses to step down. I'm David Wellness in Rio de Janeiro.
Russia's acting Prime Minister Yegor Gaidar says the country can pay foreign creditors no more than $2 billion this year. Russia is supposed to make interest payments of about $10 billion. The country has won a number of deferments on repaying principal. The former Soviet Union has about $70 billion in foreign debts. Gaidar also blamed the Russian Central Bank for the ruble's sharp fall this week. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One of the themes of President Bush's campaign is the gridlocked Democratic Congress. The president says his programs have been blocked by Congress, and that's part of why our economy is in trouble. House Speaker Tom Foley says the president created the gridlock by vetoing the bills. Is our government deadlocked, and who's to blame? Steve Roberts has been covering American politics for over 25 years, so we asked him to explain what's going on. Roberts is a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report and formerly wrote for the New York Times. He's a regular on the PBS program Washington Week in Review. I asked Roberts what the president means when he says we have a gridlocked Congress.
Well, I think the president means that he is very frustrated. We have a situation, really, Terry, where we have a coalition government in this country. The voters have chosen, in their wisdom over the last five elections, really, to not give either party a mandate, or either the Democratic Congress or the Republican White House, a clear mandate to govern this country. What they each have is the power to veto the other side's agenda. They do not have the power to enact their own agenda. And even though the president is very frustrated, I can tell you that there is an equal, if not larger, measure of frustration on Capitol Hill as well. We really have government by veto.
So the government is gridlocked?
I think the government is gridlocked most of the time, not always. This system can work, and it has worked, in two ways. It works, for instance, when both sides decide, and this is relatively rare, particularly in a political year, when both sides decide that it's more important to move on a piece of legislation than to play politics with it, substance over form. We saw this with the Clean Air Act, very, very complicated piece of legislation, many economic interests involved. Both sides were very tempted to play politics. Democrats were tempted to send a bill to George Bush that would be too strong, force him to veto it so they could go to the country and say, see, really not the environmental president. Instead, they did an interesting thing. They pulled back their stronger bill, negotiated with the White House, faced a very clear decision that they would prefer to have a bill than not have one, than have an issue. And it worked. The bill became law. George Bush signed it. It also works when there is an upswelling of pressure from around the country, Terry, that forces both parties to work together, perhaps even when they don't want to. Best example in recent months of that was extending unemployment benefits. George Bush rejected two attempts by Congress to extend unemployment benefits. By the time the third one came around, the economy was nosediving. His popularity was following the nosedive of the economy downward. And he was as eager as anything to finally sign it. So he didn't want to. He rejected two of them, but he was forced to by public pressure from outside of Washington. In those kinds of cases, the system works. But those are the exceptions rather than the rule.
Well, the president is blaming the troubled economy on the gridlocked Congress. In his State of the Union address, President Bush gave Congress a deadline to pass his economic bill, but then he vetoed the bill that Congress passed. Is that an example of the kind of politics that you're talking about?
Exactly. Interestingly enough, on that bill, Terry, both sides thought that they were winning politically from the same bill. Obviously, they're both not right. The Democrats specifically sent Bush a bill, even though it met his deadline as he has set it up in the State of the Union, and it contained a number of the proposals that George Bush wanted. When he gets up and says, my program hasn't been tried and the Democrats have stopped everything I wanted, that's a little disingenuous. The fact is that the bill that the Congress passed contained a lot of what George Bush wanted. But it also contained something he very much did not want and could not accept, which was a tax increase, particularly on wealthy taxpayers. He had been so burned by the Read My Lips pledge that he just could not sign any bill that contained a tax increase. Now, of course, the Democrats specifically put the tax increase in there, in part because they thought Bush would veto it. So both sides were playing politics. The Democrats calculated that if they raised taxes on the wealthy and cut them on the middle class, they could then take this bill and George Bush's veto and go to the country and say, see, he really just cares about the wealthy. He didn't want taxes raised on his rich friends, and he doesn't care about you average middle class voters who would have gotten a tax break out of this. The Republicans, when Bush vetoed the bill, also made a very political calculation. They say, if we veto this bill, we can go to the country and say, dear voter, they're at it again. They're taxing you. They're going to take your tax money and spend it. They might say it's only on the rich, but really don't believe them, because once they say taxes, the door is open. And in fact, taxes have been the magic bullet for Republicans for years. The Democrats are incapable of mentioning the word taxes without paying a political price. The Republicans were counting on that.
Is basically what you're saying, everybody's more worried about reelection than they are about actually doing something for the economy?
Well, I think that, yes, that in some ways is what I'm saying. If both sides of this coalition government, the Democratic Congress and the Republican White House, decide on any given issue that they want to play politics, then the system grinds completely to a halt. The only way this can work, given the fact that the voters have consistently voted for divided government. This is not, this is not an accident, and it's not something new. They have consistently voted for a Democratic Congress, which says, I'm not going to reduce domestic spending, and a president who says, I'm not going to increase your taxes. It sounds like, in fact, I'm going to cut your taxes. In effect, they voted for a free lunch, and there's no such thing. So the voters have to bear a significant part of the responsibility for this deadlock, even though they complain about it. As long as political considerations are paramount, it's going to remain that way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Roberts. He's a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, and he's covered politics and Congress for about 28 years. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the, quote, gridlocked Congress and the deadlock in our government with Steve Roberts of U.S. News and World Report. How gifted is the president at persuading Congress to vote on bills that the president wants to pass?
He is actually not a very good persuader at all, Terry. And one of the reasons why you do have this increased gridlock on Capitol Hill is that George Bush doesn't have anything like the ability his predecessor Ronald Reagan had to go to the American people, to stir up sentiment and force Congress, to intimidate Congress, to frighten Congress into doing what he wants done. I was covering Capitol Hill for the New York Times in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan was sweeping his program through Congress, even though there was a Democratic majority in the House. One of the reasons he did it was because, as Tip O'Neill, then the Speaker of the House, said to me, he said, we cannot stand up to this guy. He goes on television and stirs people up, and our offices are bombarded with calls and letters, and we have to go along with him. George Bush frightens nobody. George Bush is lousy on television. He has no sense of drama, no sense of emotion. So no one on Capitol Hill lives with any fear that if they cross the president, he can exact a punishment. And politics is a process of punishments and rewards. And he has very little to offer in the way of rewards and almost nothing to threaten in the way of punishment. So he isn't very good at it. And in fact, the one person on his staff who is good at it is Richard Darman, the budget director, who was the chief architect of the budget package back 18 months, 2 years ago, which included, of course, the famous tax increase, which resulted in Bush breaking his no new taxes pledge. That package, in the eyes of many people on Capitol Hill, was the most statesmanlike, the most courageous thing that Bush has done in his entire presidency. But because it got attacked by the right wing, he totally capitulated. He now says it was a mistake, and basically has abandoned any claim that he was doing the right thing. And that only adds to the deadlock, Terry, because it adds to the feeling that for those people who try to be responsible and try to make compromises and try to take risks, they're going to have their feet pulled out from under them. And that's what the president did on his own compromise.
You're saying that the Congress isn't afraid of the president getting on TV and criticizing the Congress before Americans.
Not at all, Terry.
But are people in Congress now worried about the strategy that the president is using, blaming Congress for the troubled economy?
Well, I think there are ripples of concern that they're never happy when they're attacked. There is some concern about it, but in fact, ironically, some of the most visible victims of the anti-incumbent, anti-Congress mood that the Republicans themselves have helped stoke up have been Republicans. We saw it just this week in Oklahoma, where the number three or four man in the House Republican leadership, Mickey Edwards, was defeated in a Republican primary. Leading Republican in the House, Guy Vanderjack of Michigan, was also defeated in a primary. Newt Gingrich barely survived. Vin Weber, another member of the Republican leadership, rather than run for re-election in a difficult race, decided to quit. So three of the major Republicans in the House have been fatally wounded by the grenades thrown by their fellow Republicans, and they ain't happy about it, I can tell you. One of the Republicans said, I don't know why Gingrich and the other bomb throwers or grenade throwers, I don't know why they thought if they threw a grenade in the middle of Congress that they could control where the explosion went.
Mm-hmm.
And they obviously have not been able to do that. I'm sure there are some nervous Democrats, but historically, Terry, the ability of a president to run against Congress has not been very great. People remember Harry Truman, but that was a long time ago when people were much more party-oriented, far less willing to think for themselves. Ronald Reagan went all over this country at the height of his popularity in 1986, urging people to vote for a Republican Congress, saying, vote for the Gipper one last time. The voters turned around and voted the Republicans out of the majority in the Senate and voted the Democrats back in, despite Ronald Reagan's best efforts. So when you see things like that, I don't think people are all that nervous.
My guest is Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Roberts says voters share some of the responsibility for the deadlock government, and that's one of the things we'll talk about after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Lynn, how are you covering the president's response to the hurricane damage in Florida?
Well, as you know, Terry, President Bush has ordered thousands of federal troops into Florida to help with the victims of Hurricane Andrew, and they're already beginning to set up some shelters and distribute food. We have a reporter there who will be covering that story for us. And I'll also be talking with a psychologist about some of the emotional problems that people down there are going through as a result of this traumatic experience. And later on a much lighter vein, we'll have an interview with Edge. He's the guitarist for the Irish rock band U2. They're on a national concert tour right now, and so we'll be talking with him in today's show.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Journalist Steve Roberts is my guest. What are some of the political and economic, social issues that you think might be getting stalled now because of the gridlock in government?
Well, it's a good question. I would divide that into sort of three areas. The first, of course, is economics, and particularly the ability to deal with the deficit. Ronald Reagan came in 12 years ago and said to people, I'm going to cut your taxes, I'm going to raise defense spending, and I'm not going to reduce social services. That was a proposal that George Bush called voodoo economics. He was right then, and he's right now. Those numbers never added up, but people didn't want to confront the fact that they never added up, and so we have a $4 trillion deficit. The only way you're going to deal with the deficit is basically to increase taxes, cut spending, or both. But people don't want to do that. If you were watching in the last day or two, for instance, stories from Florida and Louisiana, people battered by the storm, and very, very genuine suffering. I was noticing last night some people saying, where is the government? Why aren't they bailing us out? Where are they? Where's the cavalry? I bet an awful lot of those people who were saying that today, Terry, were delighted when Ronald Reagan said to them, the government's the problem, not the solution. We waste all our tax money on undeserving welfare queens, and we're going to cut your taxes to you God-fearing middle-class Americans. The fact is that people want these services. They don't want to pay for them. And with the current gridlock, it is so easy to play demagogue on this question. George Bush did it again at his own convention. He comes up and says, I'm going to cut your taxes. But he doesn't say how he's going to pay for it. And he refuses to say how he's going to pay for it until the election. Well, that just panders to the worst instincts of voters who want to believe that they can get these services for free. And so given the current gridlock and given the current penchant for playing politics, as Bush demonstrated, it's almost impossible to get well-meaning people from both sides of the aisle to get together and say, look, we're going to tell people the truth. That's the only way it's going to happen. But it's not only a failure of leadership, it's a failure of followership. Leaders are reluctant to do it because when they do it, voters turn against them. So economics is the first question, but there are many other issues that are stalled as a result of this as well. There's a whole series of bills, for instance, that relate to the family and the new nature of American families and with so many more women in the workplace. A very good example is legislation that would mandate companies of a certain size to require them to provide unpaid leave for parents of new children or people who have aging spouse aging parents who need medical care. This would make an enormous difference in the lives of a lot of stressed out American middle class families. But again, it's a political question. The Democrats are pushing a stringent bill in the hopes that Bush will veto it. Bush is against it because his friends in the big business community don't want this kind of government mandate, and so there's a deadlock. I think that efforts to reform education are another example where been stalled at over political wrangling. And there's a very long list beyond that, but those are just three examples.
Do you have any hopes that this political deadlock will be ended in the near future?
No, I don't. I think that what is probably the most likely outcome even now is that the Democrats retain strong control of the Congress and that George Bush is reelected. Now, if Bill Clinton is elected in the fall, and this week, for the first time, I believed it was really possible when I noticed that the post-convention bounce that Bush had gotten had really receded rather quickly. It's now a glimmer of possibility that Clinton actually will be elected. If that were to happen, then I think you might have a relatively brief period in the first year of the Clinton administration where Democrats controlled both the Congress and the White House, where you might see some things unstuck. But the rules of Congress are such that the Republicans almost certainly would have enough strength in the Senate to filibuster a number of pieces of legislation if they choose to take that route. So the system still would have a lot of roadblocks in it. And secondly, as I said earlier, the voters are part of this equation. Bill Clinton and Democratic Congress would have to really take some very painful measures to deal with the underlying economic problems. And it's a very open question whether they're going to have the guts to get up and tell people the truth and try to convince them of that the short-term pain is worth a long-term gain. And if they don't have that kind of courage and that kind of leadership skill, then in many ways the fact that one party controls both branches of government is not going to make all that much difference.
Since you think voters are an important part of the equation of what's wrong right now politically, what advice would you have to voters? I'm not talking about who to vote for, but about how to think about the electoral process.
Well, you know, voters are congenitally unhappy with politicians. They complain that they don't talk about the issues. They complain that they're being manipulated by negative commercials, all of which is true. But there is no real mechanism in a way because for voters to express this except at the polls. But I think that what's necessary as part of this process of ending the paralysis is for voters individually and as groups, as they organize themselves in the special interest groups or whatever, to say to the political leadership that we will support truth-telling. We will support courage. We will accept the bad news. The one person who really tried to do that during the primary campaign, of course, was Paul Tsongas. He was successful for a while. But it was Bill Clinton, more than anybody, who proved how risky it is to be a truth-teller in politics because he, during the Florida primaries and the Super Tuesday, he took some of Paul Tsongas' proposals, very modest proposals, actually, for gasoline tax increases, for certain small limits on the cost of living increases of entitlement programs, and he just rammed them down Paul Tsongas' throat. He ran against him and crushed him. So the voters at that point had the choice of voting for somebody who was telling them the truth, and they allowed someone who demagogued the issue to win the day. So I just think that the guts is needed on both sides, courage is needed on both sides, a sense of civic responsibility is needed on both sides, a sense that you can't keep spending money you don't have, and I can't keep running into debt. And voters keep saying, you know, well, those damn congressmen, they can't balance their own checkbooks. And they get very self-righteous about it. But the fact is, they do keep voting for people who won't tell them the truth.
Well, Steve Roberts, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Steve Roberts is a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report and a regular on the PBS program Washington Week in Review. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblitis, and Stephen Waterman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Special thanks to Mike Villers for loaning us his amp for the Lucinda Williams concert. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with writer Susan Sontag. Her new novel, The Volcano Lover, is a bestseller. Also, the merging of lobbying with public relations and how that's affected American politics. We'll talk with Susan Trento, author of a new book about influence peddling. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.